taking care of business. Path to Pro Radio is on.
Yes, it's true. Another edition of Path to Pro Radio. Yes. I'm Jimmy Ray Dunn, and that is Bill Crespo.
Yep, and we're here at Path to Pro Radio with a great guest today, someone that I've had the pleasure of playing some music with, and being because I'm the your typical Puerto Rican playing congas and drums. And
you know, I think I actually had a chance to play with him once.
Yeah, you did too.
It's a lot of fun. What a great guitarist.
Awesome guitar. A lot of history. We're going to talk about the business of music. We're going to talk about Roger's history and how he got involved with Jimmy Buffett's band, the original guitar player for Jimmy Buffett. Roger, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great, man. Thanks for being on. It's my pleasure. So we're on here. I'm excited. We're in Virginia Beach. Roger's in, I guess, Florida. You're in Florida right now, right?
I'm in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Mm. Rough life there, Roger. I mean, you know. You're looking out your window right now. What do you see, Roger?
I see some palm trees and
swaying
some cranes.
That's 30.
Gator.
So all these years of music have been
alligators
pretty good.
Gator's eating the neighbor's dog. I didn't like that dog anyway.
Well, you know, he's the alligator's got to eat. I'm just saying.
That's right.
Listen, and for all our PETA listeners.
Just kidding.
Psych. So, Roger, your rich history in music in general, but the fact that you teamed up with Jimmy Buffett way back in the beginning is such an interesting story. If you would kind of relate how you and Roger came, I mean, you and Jimmy came to be, that would be cool for the listener, I think.
Well, I mean, you know, you're right on the mark there. You know, in the early days, I was Jimmy Buffett and he was Roger Bartlett. But we drank so much that it got switched around. And it wasn't until the 80s when I sobered up. I was like, oh, whoa, yeah. What happened?
And the drink was margaritas, by the way.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So you met Jimmy. How did you guys come to be a team?
Well, the summer after I got out of college, I got a job in the galley of a merchant tramp steamer that was taking ladies' lingerie and auto parts to France. And Jimmy happened to be the first mate on that ship.
You know, people are listening to this, right?
On the deck and you're not buying it, huh?
No. We'd like the real story.
Yeah, not the BS story.
All right. Well, I met Jimmy in Nashville. I was in a band called the Outlaw Brothers, an acoustic trio, and we were opening for him at a place called the Exit Inn. Oh. And I've come to find out that I believe that was his first gig at the Exit Inn, you know, way back then.
Oh,
Nashville.
Wow.
Nashville was like a crazy place in those days. The country rock thing was just beginning to happen. You know, I was playing at a place also called the Red Dog Inn, where, you know, Bob Dylan was rehearsing the Nashville Skyline album there with Charlie Daniels and Norman Blake. And
now, what year was this, Roger?
1971.
Okay, wow.
And, you know, we were playing at the Red Dog, and there was a band called Mother Earth. Do you remember Mother Earth?
I do remember the name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was a girl named Tracy Nelson. And I think Linda Ronstadt recorded one of her songs. Anyway, she just got a record deal. She was about to do a big tour. And she had a band from California that was her opening act there. And the people changed at the record label. She got dropped. And this other band had to play some gigs at the Red Dog to get enough money to go back to California. It was a band called the Doobie Brothers.
Shut up. That is hilarious.
And so, you know, across town, I was opening for Jimmy at the Exit Inn. And then about a year and a half later, I ran into him in Austin, Texas, you know, where I was in another band opening for him. And toward the end of the 4 or 5 day run, I accosted him backstage and said, "Hey, you need a guitar player, me." And he said, "Well, you know, I mean, this is how tense the environment was back then." He said, "Well, come on up and sit in with me on the next set and we'll see how it goes." So I didn't really know his songs or anything. I got up there and I sort of watched his hands playing the guitar and, you know, tried to mumble some harmony there, you know, like, yeah, my name, it'll be
like what I do right now.
So, you know, the next thing I knew, we were playing the Troubadour in L.A., wow, opening up for another singer-songwriter guy named Hoyt Axton.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. So you did a good job of faking your way through that set in Nashville then.
Well, you know, back in those days, you know, everybody was so artificially inspired that, you know, who knows what happened.
I like that, artificially inspired.
That's kind of how I feel about my wife and I and her accepting my proposal. Like, yeah. I think she was artificially inspired that day. Yeah.
No, she was. She told me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it was only one drink. Strong. It was strong, though.
So you started, once you got into the band, then how did you guys started collaborating? Because he let you in, and then now it's writing songs together?
Not really. You know, to tell you the truth, I was kind of overwhelmed getting out on the road. The first gig was there at the Troubadour in L.A. The next gig we did, we flew to New England, did a tour with Three Dog Night.
Wow. Okay.
Flew with them on their DC-3. And that kind of intimidated me. And so I kind of held back and, you know, he mostly writing off the road. He'd go back to Key West and I'd go back to Austin. So, you know, we didn't really, I mean, we hung out on the road and everything, but it was like, you know, let's go to the airport, let's go to the gig, you know, let's take the college girls back to the, college. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of time for writing and stuff.
Yeah. And those days, when you were saying you were, you know, artificially inspired, those were also days, if I remember correctly, that there was a lot of jamming going on. It's like, you
there
know,
was a lot of jamming, you
take,
know,
take I a mean, solo was, and then you take a solo and then everybody takes a solo.
Well, with two acoustic guitars, you know, there wasn't really that much jamming.
All right. Okay. All right.
So, you know, in the early days, it was just me and him.
Oh, so how big was the band at the time?
Just me and him.
Oh, so it's just both of you guys. Okay, I get it now.
Now, when did Harry Daly come into the picture? The bass player was a friend of mine.
Yeah, we've been on the road for, oh, I don't know, a year and a half or so. And we started playing gigs. You know, we played one gig. We played a festival in Oklahoma. Two acoustic guitars for 135,000 people.
Wow.
And, you know, kind
holy
of
smokes.
Kind of wish you had like a rhythm section for that, you know?
Yeah, that would have been nice.
Wow.
And other club gigs, you know, where, you know, when I first went to work for him, there was all these folk clubs, you know, where they didn't even serve alcohol during the show. You know, they shut everything down so people were quiet. I mean, if you can imagine that, I know it's beyond the
realm. It's kind of like the Bluebird now. The Bluebird in Memphis, in Nashville.
Yeah, yeah, like that, you know.
Like church.
So, you know, it was a whole different environment, but there was just two of us, so he was not really a jammer.
So interesting.
Oh, on the road, we'd run into people. We'd go sit in with John Prine and I remember crawling up on the stage in Cambridge, Massachusetts with John Prine and playing along with him.
Were you crawling because you were artificially inspired?
Well, partly, but also because we were out in front of the stage and instead of trying to go back around and come back through the backstage, we just crawled up on the stage.
So then the band starts getting bigger and bigger. I mean, because this thing is like
a year and a half. Yeah, we one day he decided we needed a band. So a guy named Gove Scrivener. Oh, I don't know if you know Gove.
Absolutely.
He's from that area. He was the one, I think, that offered Harry's name up. And I got a drummer from Austin, a guy named Philip Fajardo. And naturally, Fingers came into the fold. So.
Well, when Roger says that area, it's southeastern Virginia is the area that Harry Daly was from here and Gove.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. That's really cool because, you know, I don't think most people, you know, when they go to these concerts and they see, you know, Jimmy's still touring, a little less these days, but still touring. But when you're in the audience and you see the players on stage and it's like such a glamorous life is the impression, perception. But the real story is, I mean, it's, of course, especially back then, it was probably a lot of partying and stuff. But I mean, it's not quite as glamorous as one might think at times. Am I right?
Well, no, not really, you know, because everybody's tired and, you know, you're going from one gig to the next gig and, you know, you've got like, you know, people who want to insinuate themselves into your group there. And, you know, you don't, sometimes it's hard. It's not people that you want to hang around.
Right.
And so, you know, and, you know, you have things like I can remember, you know, going on stage and having a guy stop me on the way to the stage with my guitar on and saying, "Hey, Roger, make me famous." And I was like, you know what? If I could make somebody famous, it would be me.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. I'm still working on me.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. And the licks that you were able to write, can you just share with us some of the songs that you participated on and help Jimmy make millions of dollars off of?
Well, here's one. You know, when I left the band, I left because there was too much artificial inspiration.
Oh, and, okay.
Got it. You know,
so I would run into Harry after that, and Harry would say, you know, that lick on Margaritaville, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. He'd say, you wrote that. And I was like, yeah, you know, I don't remember playing that song. You know, and then a guy wrote a book called Jimmy Buffett, A Good Life All the Way. And he said, do you remember playing on Margaritaville? And I was like, I don't think he'd written that song when I was in the band. He said, no, he had. He said, I've got a tape of you playing that song for the first time at the Roxy in Los Angeles. And he sent me this recording of us. And there I am going, da 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 da.
That is amazing. Yeah, so I guess the proof is in the recording. You did do it. And then you went...
That's me. I did it.
I did it. It was me. And then, you know, the one you talked about, because we were able to share some conversation when you're up in Virginia Beach, the most famous movie of them all that you wrote the score on. What was that movie?
It was not the score. I had one song.
One song.
It was a song called Fool for a Blonde. And it was the love theme from the movie The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I didn't know there was a love theme.
Well, I mean, I just like to think of it that way.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, good for you, brother. And a lot of the stuff that you did in your earlier years, is it still paying Roger to live in St. Pete?
I still get royalty checks. Yeah. You know, I mean, it helps pay for my yacht and my house in Monaco.
Yeah. The jet.
You know, and, you know, helps support my 25-year-old trophy wife.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah.
Hey, man. And his Cialis prescription.
Yeah.
Well, I really want to bring that up.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry, man.
Come on, man. This is getting too personal. This is a family. Is this a family show?
I'm not sure. It could be a family show.
Yeah.
And Adam's then, family.
So, you know, because we have business people that listen to us and salespeople, this whole business of getting involved in music, what have you seen change so much over the years in this industry? Because things have changed.
Oh, radically. You know, there used to be middle class musician jobs out there, you know, like every dance club had a band. Now no dance club has a band.
Right.
You know, used to be like every hotel had a club with a band in the bar. Now no hotel has a club with a band in the bar. You know, when you got a song played on the radio, you know, you used to make a nickel every time the song played on the radio. And I think 2 cents if you were on the B-side or on the album, you know. Now you get a thousandth of a penny, you know, for a stream, or a hundredth of a penny, or you know, the weird thing is the more streams you get, the less they pay.
Wow.
So you think, you're saying maybe you think that the way that the music has progressed, if that's the right term, in terms of technology.
Evolved, I would say evolved.
Yeah, evolved. Has changed the business 180.
Well, it has, yeah. I mean, it's great that people could record their own stuff. I mean, you could set up with a computer and get a really great sound and recording out of the computer, but you know, that also opened the floodgates to glut the market. You know, I mean, the record labels did sort of skim the cream off of the top of the musicians out there. Now everybody's, you know, got a release. So it's hard to break through the clutter, but, you know, it's good if you're, you know, just trying to do something, but bad if you're trying to break through. So
I'm wondering when this all, you know, Jimmy's been on the radio for over 30 years and you guys been playing, you know, I'm just the business guy here that
Typical guy. Over 30 years. Next year will be 50 years since I went to work for him.
Wow. 50 years. What do you,
and
do,
I'm only 26.
I know. I was going to say, crazy. You look like you're freaking like 20.
That was 25 years before your wife was born.
Yes. That's right. So thank you. Okay. So next on the show, but listen, and Jimmy, you may also want to chime in on this. What point in history did this start to change where everything started to, like, you know, bands actually were paid more money in the clubs some time ago? What do you see, a point in time where this, you saw the change take place?
Well, you know, when the 80s hit and computers started getting involved, that's when everything started changing drastically. Drum machines came in. You know, it's odd that, you know, in the 1930s and the 40s you could have a 25-piece big band in the club, but now you can only do an acoustic duo with tracks, you know. It's like, where did all that money go? And I think part of the answer is also the internet. You know, because people have so many more entertainment choices, and, you know, you used to have places like the Bitter End in New York, you know, where you could go there and see Joni Mitchell or Jerry Jeff Walker or Woody Allen or Thelonious Monk, you know. But now you go to the Bitter End and it's like five different bands a night. And this band brings in their 20 people. When they finish, they leave with their 20 people. The next band comes in with their 20 people, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I noticed on a local level, Roger and Bill, that at least in this area, that when the anti-drunk driving movement began, MAD, that really affected supporting local bands. The crowd size went down, support went down, and I mean, it had a big effect on people wanting to go to a bar and even having a drink because they didn't want to stop in a roadblock on the way home or get in an accident, whatever. So, I mean, I really think that's when I saw, at least locally, that the attendance to local bands or bands dropped dramatically in the support.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think that's probably, you know, a product of the people you hung around with.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Very possibly could be. Yeah.
We're going back to that same thing.
Artificially.
Yeah, artificially. It always goes back to that, you know, because
it all changed over time, you know, but people used to, you know, revere musicians. I mean, you know, Clapton is God, or, you know, Miles, you know, have you played for Miles? You know, now it's like, you know, anybody with a computer, you know, you don't really have to learn how to play. You can get an app that'll make a song for you. You know, I see things on the web where you can buy MIDI chord progressions and make your song over this chord progression that's already written for you, you know.
And I like this. And you know, one thing I've noticed too on Instagram, at least, is that there are so many millions of fabulous players around the world, and social media has produced a venue for them to put out videos of themselves playing. Yeah. And there are just, I mean, and that has just made it so obvious to me how many great players there are, and they're never going to get a record deal, but they are just so good. And there's millions
of a lot
of
fantastic players out there. But, you know, on my Facebook site there, I post some of those great musicians, you know, and I'll get like one like or three likes, you know. But then I put a picture of a buxom young lady holding a basket of tomatoes, and you know, I get like 100 likes.
Click.
Yeah. 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 It's so interesting to see. And the one thing that I think about when I listen to you play, because I have been fortunate is to do you up on stage with you, you know, you're serious about your music. I mean, do you continue to practice on a regular basis? I think people want to know, you know, you've had all these years, you know, how do you stay? Well, you do play a lot still now in gigs, but how do you stay fresh?
Well, you know, I try to listen to new styles of music and learn new stuff all the time. Since I got down to Florida, I tell you, you know, my style has changed pretty dramatically. You know, I got into all this Latin kind of stuff, Caribbean kind of stuff, kind of jazzy stuff. I always had a jazzy side, but I was more of a blues guy. But down here, I've really kind of embraced more of the jazz thing and some Latin rhythms and stuff. And, you know, songs just keep coming to me. I don't know why. You know, I did an album in 2021. I thought that was going to be the last record that I did. And then all of a sudden, like 9 new songs popped out. So, you know, wow. Working on a new album now.
Now, in that vein, are you collaborating with anybody? Is sending songs to any particular artists that we might know?
You know, it's so hard to pitch songs these days because, you know, publishing is where the money is. Mm-hmm. And I will brazenly, you know, accost somebody if I have the opportunity, cold email somebody, say, hey, can I pitch you a song? And, you know, but I tried to pitch a song to a jazz artist, you know, and I got an email back from their management said, you know, he only does songs that are published by Warner Chappell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So if they don't have it, you know, you can't pitch it to them. So
when you pitch a song and someone picks up your music, what's the deal there? How does that work? Because you know, they always say that the writers are making more than the musicians. And so how does that work money-wise?
Well, you know, if you get a big artist, say I was to pitch a song to somebody like, I guess Justin Bieber's not really a songwriter, so we use a
George
artist.
Strait. George Strait, even. He doesn't write his songs.
Well, George Strait's kind of a legacy artist, too. Say Kenny Chesney.
Right.
You know, you pitch a song to Kenny Chesney, you know, he likes it, you know, he's going to take all the publishing. You know, there's 200% of a song. There's 100% of the writer's side and 100% of the publishing side. Well, if you get somebody really popular like Kenny Chesney, he's going to take all the publishing. So that's half the song gone. And in a lot of cases, the artist will also take half of the writers. So the original writer will only end up with like 25% of the song.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
But what is the amount? Like, say, what is that amount? So, I mean, so you're taking a percent of what?
Well, it depends on how successful the song is.
Right. So if it hits number one, that's the dream, right? You go up there and then.
Well, if it's number one, then you know, you stand to make, even if you only end up with 25% of the song, you stand to make a fair amount of money. I mean, a lot of songs out of Nashville have 4 or 5 different writers. Uh-huh. You know, 2, 3, 4, 5. I remember going to a BMI awards ceremony there for some people, and you know, there were like, for one song there was 6 writers up on stage. Like, my God, what did you write? Oh, I wrote the.
What about the actual producing of it and the production side of it? Do they get a piece?
Well, the producer I'm not sure what the producer gets now. The producer used to get a piece of the album sales,
like a point or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, 0.2 points, something like that. But there's, you know, not that much in the way of album sales anymore. Everybody's streaming, and the record labels still do really well off of streaming. Like when they had that whole Neil Young, Joe Rogan, kerfuffle not too long ago, I was surprised to learn that the record labels get 70% of the revenue from Spotify.
Good Lord.
Yeah, so you know, and then the Spotify guy is a billionaire, so he's taking a big cut. And when I get my Spotify royalty statement, you know, I make like, you know, like I got 141 or 114,000 streams on YouTube, you know, for my song Fool for a Blonde. And I made $12.89.
We're going to Sonic. Honey, it's Sonic tonight.
That's right.
That's right. Right. But I'm it's Dutch.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. Everyone's got to do their own. So where do you think this is going, man? I mean, you know, the industry has changed so much. You've got electronics all over the place. And, you know, where did you think this industry is heading to? And then there's people that are like, look at what's his face, Toby Keith, who left, does his own thing.
Yeah, he's got his own label, but he's going back on tour in 23.
Yeah.
But he said, screw Nashville. And that's why you don't see Toby at a CMA, because he doesn't play the politic thing in Nashville. But where do you think the industry is going, Roger, in terms of if I'm a aspiring, budding talent out here that writes good songs, I think, and people have liked, where do you think it's going, and how would somebody like that maybe even have a chance to get a foothold in?
Well, it's really tough. You know, you got to go where the music is happening. You know, if you're doing country, you got to go to Nashville. If you're doing pop, you got to go to L.A. or New York.
Got to be present to win.
Yeah. And you know, when you start out, you know, things over the course of your lifetime, it's all who you meet and hang out with. Right. Like when I first got to Nashville, there was a cornucopia of artists there. Like me and my two cohorts, the Outlaw Brothers, we ran into a crazy guy there that we worked for a little while named David Allan Coe.
No way. That's awesome. You know,
and then we didn't work for him for very long because he was too crazy. But then, you know, I met lots of other songwriters there. A guy named Even Steven, who's a big songwriter in Nashville. You know, I met Jimmy Buffett there, and you know, really, they say if you don't do something big by the time you're 30, it's probably not going to happen.
Wow.
In this business.
Yeah. That's. I saw you. You were on stage on some big thing just recently. Like, saw you on your Facebook page. A couple guys. Yeah. What was that gig about?
You know, I played a whole bunch of gigs lately. I just did a gig with John Frenzy where I was a side man, but I do gigs where I've got the advantage of I can be a side man as well as a front man. So I've got two avenues to pursue, but
that's great. You are you and Jimmy still talking, man? You guys still?
No, I haven't spoken to him. I don't know. 6-7 years, something like that.
Yeah, and the other guys in the band, I see you sometimes playing with the guy.
I do speak to them. I Mike Utley played on my last record, who's a keyboard player with Jimmy now, and you know, I did a show in Annapolis, Maryland, and Peter Mayer and his son Brendan Mayer were on the bill. You know, and I was appearing there with John Frenzy and Aaron Schurz. You know, two other singer-songwriters, and we traded songs on stage there.
Yeah, I think this is where my sister saw you, and I said, stay away from that guy, Roger.
Yeah. Oh, that was your sister,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Said, no. So,
I said, hi.
Yeah. Said, did you meet Roger? Oh, sure. No. So Roger, you know, it's so cool to learn this business from you. I mean, you've been in the business, Roger, you said 50 years. I mean, you've seen this thing change, and you know, I'm always, it's always fun to have you come up here because you're definitely a serious, even though you joke a lot, but you are, when you're up on stage, I mean, you're doing
incredible. He's the real deal, man.
Yeah, I mean, people go, well, what was that note? We play it all the time, but we never heard that one before. That's because he wrote it or he played it.
Yeah.
Well, Roger, we can't thank you enough, man. And I hope you have a great holiday down there in the Tampa St. Pete area.
Yeah, go to your Facebook page. Go to Roger's Facebook.
Good holiday up there, too.
Thank you, brother. What's your Facebook page? People can check you out.
It's Roger Bartlett.
How do you spell that? No, I'm just kidding. All right, Roger, see ya. Have a Merry Christmas.
All right, same to you. See ya.
Peace out.